toward Winter Rock. I'm Richard Davis.
Traditional games are being revived in places like South Dakota, where they teach kids a range of lessons, from cooperation to native language. More from Kathleen Shannon.
Jeremy Red Eagle is a member of the Sistem Wahpeton Oyate of the Lake Traverse Reservation and is leading a movement to revive traditional games in Native communities. Sports that come from Native people, including lacrosse and archery, Red Eagle says, teach teamwork, cooperation, respect, and historically, survival skills.
Our people lived off of the land. We lived according to natural law. Physically, mentally, emotionally, we had to be strong in all of those areas of our life. And these games were a way of developing that.
After Native language, identity, and teachings were nearly eradicated during colonization, Red Eagle says games offer kids a unique way to reconnect with those aspects of culture. The games also foster connections between players and their environment, Red Eagle says. Some games require crafting supplies from natural materials.
When I work with young people, take them out, have them harvest willows or whatever it is that we're doing, we're sharing other teachings that are connected to it through the culture, the language, but you're getting them to be grounded in the land.
Red Eagle invites people of all ages to participate. He says games help bridge the generational gap. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 31st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tegedoff, Isabel Chalet, and Althea Billings. The producers Annette Newell and our engineers Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Will fascists govern America? The BRICS meeting in Russia brings together the alternative world order, and China's harassment of Taiwan intensifies. First, will fascists govern America? As November 5th approaches, let's face a political reality. Two of the most powerful men in America are fascists, and they are a step away from being in charge. Granted that fascist has become a very loose term of opprobrium to apply to dictatorial personalities, it's still worth using, if only to clarify the frightening tendencies of would-be dictators. That means Donald Trump, first of all. General Mark Milley has called Trump a fascist, and General John Kelly, Trump's former chief of staff, has followed suit. Kelly, in a series of interviews published October 22nd, said Trump's behavior fit, quote, into the general definition of fascist, and that Trump wanted the kind of generals Hitler had. Trump, some time back, said Hitler did some good things, and he has never disavowed that belief. Kelly also confirmed to The Atlantic magazine that Trump had said he wished his military personnel showed him the same deference Adolf Hitler's Nazi generals showed the German dictator during World War II, and recounted the moment. "Do you mean Bismarck's generals?" Kelly told The Atlantic he had asked Trump. He added, "I mean, I knew he didn't know who Bismarck was or about the Franco-Prussian War, I said, "Do you mean the Kaiser's generals? Surely you can't mean Hitler's generals." And Trump said, yeah, Hitler's generals. I explained to him that Rommel had to commit suicide after taking part in a plot against Hitler. Elon Musk is the other notable fascist. He gets away with murder because of his enormous wealth, virtually all of which is untouchable, inasmuch as all but one of his companies, Tesla, is publicly traded, and that one is stocked with his cronies. So when he plays with neo-Nazi themes, he pays no penalty. To wit, from CNN, October 21st, quote, "Musk invoked the names of two German Nazis in a tweet, attempting, as he so often does, to make a joke. Musk was responding to a Der Spiegel article in Germany that compared him to a media mogul who helped Hitler climb to power. A month earlier, Musk promoted Tucker Carlson's widely condemned interview with a Nazi apologist who said the murder of Jews in concentration camps was humane and that Winston Churchill was the chief villain of World War II. Musk later deleted his ex post, but he called the interview very interesting and worth watching. Now, thanks to an exclusive report by the Wall Street Journal, we also know that Musk and Vladimir Putin, a fellow fascist, have regularly talked, and not just about the weather. Their conversations, says the journal, ranged from the personal to the geopolitical and included a request from the Russian leader not to activate his Starlink satellite internet service over Taiwan as a favor to the Chinese leader and Putin ally, Xi Jinping. Musk's favors to Russia include allowing Russian disinformation on X. Keep in mind that Musk has a top secret security clearance for his SpaceX satellites, has poured huge sums into Trump's campaign, and has been promised a high position in a Trump presidency. Put Musk's contacts with Putin together with Trump's several recently reported conversations with Putin, and you have a peek into the future of U.S. foreign policy. Appeasement of Russia and admiration of dictators. But you also have a warning of what a Trump-Musk administration will do to America, carrying out Project 2025's authoritarian agenda, disregarding constitutional norms, and making war on enemies within. It's a frightening prospect, don't you think? A BRICS meeting in Russia brings together the alternative world order. Last week, Russia chaired a summit meeting of BRICS leaders in the city of Kazan. BRICS stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It was a publicity coup of sorts for Vladimir Putin, who is a wanted criminal in many countries, yet continues to conduct diplomacy with those that share his resentment of the West. And that group is fairly large. The five BRICS core members are constantly expanding. Now Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, and the United Arab Emirates have joined, and several other countries are applying to join. In all, 32 countries attended, led by China. The BRICS now has a new development bank, meant to one day rival the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. When the group first formed in 2009, it was dismissed in Western circles as nothing more than a talking shop of the discontented. But now, Kevin Johnson writes in the magazine Foreign Policy, quote, "It is hard to appreciate just how much resentment there is of Western hypocrisy and hegemony, all mortar, helping to bond the loose membership of BRICS," unquote. The key bond seems to be development financing. During the summit, the leaders of China and Iran met. Iran's newly elected president, Masoud Pezeshkian, said, quote, "China is Iran's most important partner for cooperation." He added that, quote, "Iran is all ready to begin work with China to continue firmly supporting each other on issues concerning their respective core interests and opposing hegemony and bullying," unquote. Xi Jinping replied, quote, "The Chinese side supports Iran in safeguarding national sovereignty, security, and national dignity, steadily advancing its own economic and social development, and improving and deepening good neighborly and friendly relations with neighboring countries." Also important was a speech by India's Prime Minister Modi calling for reform of the major international security and financial institutions. He said, quote, "We must move forward in a time-bound manner on reforms in global institutions such as the UN Security Council, multilateral development banks, and the World Trade Organizations. As we take our efforts forward in BRICS, we must be careful to ensure that the organization does not acquire the image of one that is trying to replace global institutions instead of being perceived as one that wishes to reform them," unquote. Modi also urged greater financial integration among the BRICS members, using local currencies, presumably instead of the U.S. dollar. The BRICS has a new development bank, and its head, Dilma Rousseff, spoke about moving away from the dollar in development financing, saying, quote, "The new development bank envisages and wants to focus on financing in national currencies. This is very important for us to increase our capacity for financing. This is our strategy. The target for 2022 to 2026 was to implement 30% of financing in national currencies. Today we have reached 28%. While the new BRICS Bank is making headway, two key U.S. economic development programs are on the verge of expiring in Congress: the International Development Finance Corporation and the African Growth and Opportunity Act. Congressional authorization for both of those programs expires in September 2025, and if Trump is elected, they are sure to be eliminated as wasteful. China's harassment of Taiwan intensifies. China's military drill around Taiwan last week deployed the most air and naval craft ever, 153 military aircraft and 26 ships. The drill put Chinese forces all around the island, conveying the idea that China is capable of blockading Taiwan. Of particular interest to military experts is China's increasing deployment of heavily armed Coast Guard vessels with the usual naval craft. As I've mentioned in previous broadcasts, the reason for the deployments was Beijing's anger at Taiwan President Lai Ching-te in a speech in which he said Beijing, quote, has no right to represent Taiwan and that Taiwan is a sovereign nation. That crosses China's long-standing red line on Taiwan's independence. The day after the drill, the harassment dropped to the more usual number, around 22 aircraft. But Beijing has announced it will conduct live fire drills in the Taiwan Strait in coming weeks. These are the kinds of exercises that are not merely provocative, but can lead to misreadings and disastrous miscalculations on all sides. In other news, the G7 approves using Russian assets to help Ukraine. It took forever, but the G7 group of major economies finally approved using about $50 billion in frozen Russian central bank funds to help rebuild Ukraine. Never before has a multilateral coalition frozen the assets of an aggressor country and then harnessed the value of those assets to fund the defense of the aggrieved party, said Dalip Singh, the White House's Deputy National Security Advisor for International Economics. But the action is much less than it could be. G7 countries hold around $300 billion in Russian bank assets, which were frozen when Russia invaded Ukraine. The $50 billion is actually a loan to be paid off with the roughly $3 billion the assets earn in interest as they sit mainly in Brussels. One European specialist said, quote, "We are moving away from not just providing support for Ukraine to actually punishing Russia. We should remember that this money is legally, in principle, still Russian money, and they're now funding their enemy," unquote. But the specialist acknowledged that if Trump is elected, the whole matter will be up for reconsideration. A State Department officer resigns in protest. If you didn't hear Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Broadcast on October 23rd, you missed a particularly poignant interview with Hala Rarit, a career diplomat who served 18 years before resigning in protest over the Biden administration's Gaza policy. As Israel's war continues, her anguish over U.S. policy deserves attention. Here are excerpts. Quote, "The reality is that we, as the United States government, are in violation of multiple U.S. laws, the Leahy Law, the Foreign Assistance Act, the Arms Export Control Act. We continue to willfully violate laws so that we can surge U.S. military assistance to Israel. To what end? We are only empowering Benjamin Netanyahu to expand the conflict in Gaza, to expand the conflict within the West Bank, and now we're seeing the devastation in Lebanon. Again, to what end? We saw the Lebanese foreign minister insist that Nasrallah and Hezbollah had actually agreed to the U.S. and French proposal for a ceasefire before he was assassinated. There are other ceasefires in Gaza that we have been pushing, that Netanyahu is the obstacle. Yet this administration refuses to shift its policy, refuses to enforce U.S. law, and continues to surge U.S. military assistance. And the result has been devastating, absolutely devastating. These are human beings in Gaza that are being absolutely massacred, children. and this is going to have generational impacts and ultimately will not keep Israel any safer. And the entire region is destabilized, as we're seeing now with the threat of Iran. The policy has to change, and it has to change now." Unquote. Finally, three updates from Korea, Georgia, and Israel. From Korea, the U.S. has confirmed the presence of North Korean troops training in Russia's Far East for deployment to Ukraine. The Pentagon has upped the original figure of 3,000 soldiers to 10,000, and now says some North Korean soldiers are already in Kursk, where Russian and Ukraine troops are engaged. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov would not confirm these claims, but justified Russia's strategic partnership with North Korea by saying, quote, "Western military personnel long have been working in Ukraine," unquote. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin suggested the North Korean presence is a sign of Putin's desperation, saying, quote, "This is an indication that he may be in even more trouble than most people realize. He went tin cupping early on to get additional weapons and materials from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea," meaning North Korea, "and then from Iran, and now he's making a move to get more people," unquote. On to Georgia, where people went to the polls Saturday in a parliamentary vote that essentially was a choice between joining the European Union or kowtowing to Russia. The Georgian Dream Party, which has dominated in recent years, favors closeness to Russia, and it came out on top with about 54% of the vote. Georgia's pro-EU president dismissed the result, saying, quote, "This election cannot be recognized because it is the recognition of Russia's intrusion here." She called on Georgia's four other parties to unite in protest. Polls before the election found a decisive majority of voters favored continued involvement in the European Union, which Georgia only joined last December. That bid is on hold as the EU has watched Georgia slide deeper into authoritarianism. A European watchdog group said after the results were announced, quote, "We continue to express deep concerns about the democratic backsliding in Georgia. The conduct of yesterday's election is unfortunately evidence to that effect." Finally, from Israel, the Knesset, or parliament, voted to ban from Israel the United Nations agency that has been essential to providing health, educational, and food services to Palestinian refugees, the UN Relief and Works Agency. The ban follows attacks by the Israeli far right on the agency's supposed links with Hamas. The U.S. State Department had urged Israel not to pass the legislation, citing the, quote, "irreplaceable role it plays right now in Gaza." And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks very much for listening, and take good care.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We lost our good friend Sam A. Mowry a few months ago. Sam was a towering figure here in Portland as an actor, both on stage and behind the mic, a director, and a giant of radio theater, especially in his role as artistic director of the group he founded, Willamette Radio Workshop. Sam loved Halloween and producing audio tales of terror for the occasion. While he's no longer with us, his work lives on, and we continue the tradition on tonight's News In Depth. We present for your enjoyment Willamette Radio Workshop's production of The Wind That Shakes the Corn, which originally aired on KABU's stage and studio. Adapted for radio by William S. Gregory, the piece features Sam as our narrator, along with the voices of Janet Penner, Coble and Tony Lima, Cynthia McGean, James Lawrence, and Chris Porter, with original music by Martin John Gallagher, produced and directed by Sam, who also contributed some amazing sound effects. It's a radio tale of terror, guaranteed to send chills down your spine.
The wind blows through time, through space, over the landscape of memory. It's the middle of the previous century, in the autumn of the year. The landscape of gentle hills rolls into the distance, covered with rustling fields of corn. Dark oak trees, their leaves brilliant orange in the golden autumn light, stand beside white frame houses nestled in the cornfields. The sky and roads are a light gray, which fades to white in the distance. Down the roadside come two children making the long trek home from the rural school bus stop.
One witch, two witch, three witch, a dozen, four witch, five witch, all of them cousins.
Oh, we shouldn't say that anymore.
Why not? Halloween.
But it's about Miss Rachel, and that's her house there.
That Miss Rachel?
A long time ago, when her pa died, her cousins came to live with her, and all the ladies lived on the place for years and years, and now Miss Rachel's the only one left.
She's a witch? She can't be. She was always so nice. When Trigger got in that fight, she gave me some stuff that made his paw feel better so fast that even the vet was wowed.
Of course she's not a witch. She's a good neighbor, but we'd better leave off till we pass her place.
She's on the porch. Hi, Miss Rachel.
Hello, Eddie. Hello, Holly.
Afternoon, Miss Rachel.
It's a beautiful day.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, remember to come by to get the apple cider for the party tonight.
Yes, ma'am. She's got the best cider around.
See you kids tonight.
Goodbye, Miss Rachel.
Bye, Miss Rachel.
And along the road they go, their imaginations filled with the taste of golden cider, like the sweetness of autumn in a glass. Up at the crisp white railing of the old farmhouse porch, Miss Rachel watches the children run along the road. Two colorful leaves in the bright fall sunlight. Miss Rachel's eyes have seen many falls, and many leaves, and many children. In her memory, they swirl together against the backdrop of the dry cornfields. Miss Rachel's gray eyes have seen many falls, and many leaves, and many children. As she steps into the well-swept hall of her house, the cathedral radio in the front room breaks off its soft melody and begins to mutter in sibilant bursts.
We interrupt this program. This important news flash at 11 a.m. There is a bank robbery which is foiled. Three fugitives who are armed and extremely dangerous. We now return you to our afternoon music.
Miss Rachel touches her spider-soft hand to the brown console, and the music resumes. But a frown, quick as the flash of a crow's wing, passes over her brow and the corn around the house rattles. Evening fills the valleys on the last day of the old month. The golden light turns amber as the shadows stretch. The birds and the few remaining insects grow quiet as though caught in its stillness. In the tall kitchen at the back of the house, Miss Rachel prepares her dinner. A single chop rests on a small tin pan, and a pot of greens simmers on the white enamel stove. On the wooden table in the center of the room, two glass jugs of cider catch the last glow of the fading light in their smooth depths. A shadow slaps against the screen door. A thick hand grabs the handle, and a large man steps into the kitchen.
Oh!
You alone?
I live here.
Husband? Son?
No.
Give me some food.
I don't think I know you.
I said...
I heard what you said.
Then do it. I'm hungry.
I've got some scraps.
Give me that, on the stove. What you're eating.
Suit yourself. It's bland food for a big man like you.
Don't talk so much. Not out there.
But the dining room is...
I'll eat in the kitchen. I don't like the road.
No one comes by.
Bad luck for you.
You came through the corn.
What?
You didn't come up the road.
So?
Over the fields from the highway.
So what? Give me the food!
Silent, Miss Rachel serves the meat and greens. The man eats with a voracious appetite. He glances from time to time out the window or the screen door at the fading light on the cornfields. Miss Rachel imagines... She imagines the battered car squealing through the dusty October streets of town and out onto the highway. She imagines a fight in the car. The shoving, the tumble of a body flying out the car door and landing at the side of the highway. She imagines the flight into the cornfield. The clattering of the stalks.
They left you.
What?
They threw you out. Were you making trouble? Did you start shooting?
Shut up!
Miss Rachel sees the bulge of the gun in his clothes. She smells the gritty oil lubricating the cylinder.
You did start shooting. At the bank. You didn't care.
You talk too much.
Miss Rachel looks out the window above the farmhouse sink. The last light slips away and the pane of glass becomes a rectangle of ebony blackness. In the swirling depths, Miss Rachel sees.
All right, hands up! This is a sticker! Nobody moves!
Take it easy, take it easy. Hiya, kid. Don't be scared. We're doing our trick-or-treating a little early. Just give us the money and everything will be fine.
Yes, sir.
That's a good girl. Put it in the sack. You're not scared, are you?
No, sir.
Good, because everything's going to be Jake. How old are you, kid? 20?
17, sir.
This your first job?
Yes, sir.
Well, you're doing great.
Don't move, you people.
Easy there. Keep calm.
Just don't try anything or you're dead. You hear me? Dead. Shut up!
Don't mind him. Just keep putting the bundles in the bag and we'll be out of here.
Yes, sir.
What the hell's going on here?
Trace is the cop.
What the hell are you doing? He's just a guard. Come on, we gotta get out of here.
Oh, God.
You shot the kid.
Come on, let's get out of here.
What's happening? My dress is wet. My dress is wet.
That's how it was.
It's good grub, even if you do talk too much.
And Otto threw you out of the car.
Harold's a chump. He's scared. He ain't ready for the big time. Hey, how'd you know about Otto?
Each past has a smell. Yours stinks.
I don't like you talking that way.
No. I don't suppose you do, Ben Teller.
How'd you know my name?
From the stench.
Hey, what's going on around here? Get away from those knives.
I don't need a knife, Ben Teller.
Yeah, you better not have a gun hid someplace.
I don't need a gun, Ben Teller.
Miss Rachel stands at the screen door looking out above the high hill of the cornfield behind the house. A sound comes down off the hill. Down from the sky, down from the reaches of time itself.
What's that?
The wind.
Like the distant sound of a train, buried deep in the bowels of a mountain tunnel, the sound comes to Ben Teller's ears.
What do you mean, the wind?
The wind that shakes the corn.
Like the sound of the ocean heard miles inland before it can be seen, the sound speaks of a gigantic force.
Are you doing that?
I called, but it comes for you.
What do you mean for me?
Like a black river moving through the midnight countryside, the wind pushes forward.
For what you did to Mona.
On the edge of the field, on the other side of the hill, the corn stalks begin to shift and chatter.
Who the hell is Mona?
The girl.
What girl?
The noise of the wind runs up the distant side of the hill. The stalks clatter like hollow bones.
What girl?
The girl at the bank.
The wind crests over the hill, high above the house. The corn stalks shake, almost marching forward in the night.
It was...
You killed her.
The wind crashes down the hill and plows through the field like a boat cutting through still water. The stalks bend in its spreading wake.
This is crazy!
Teller backs away from the open door. The hairs on his neck rise. The skin tingles with dread.
I'm getting the hell out of here!
The great wind hits the back of the house like an invisible wave. It boils up the back steps, over the porch, through the screen door, across the kitchen, and into the hall. All around the house, the cornfields thrash in manic glee. The wind catches him in the darkened hall.
No! God, no! No! No!
Miss Rachel stands alone in the October night, the cornstalks shatter and still. The moon shines down on two small figures crunching up the pale gravel road to Miss Rachel's house.
My costume's better.
Well, ugh, who'd want to be a stinky old pirate?
Better than a prissy princess.
Is not.
Is so.
Why? Just look at the two of you. Don't you look fierce? And don't you look beautiful?
Thank you, Miss Rachel.
You're here for the cider, aren't you? It's back on the kitchen table.
I'll get it.
Careful now. They're heavy.
The pirate pads down the hall and returns with a jug of golden cider under each arm.
Oof. Here, give me one.
No, I've got it.
The princess takes one of the jugs to the pirate's secret relief.
Have a nice time at the party. Happy Halloween.
Thank you, Miss Rachel. Oh, and I like your new scarecrow out in the field. He's really creepy.
Thank you, dear.
Yeah, but aren't his clothes kind of city-fied?
Oh, don't worry about that. The wind will take care of it.
So blood for blood, without remorse, I've taken in the glen. I've placed my true love's clayful corpse. I join true Irishmen. But around her grave I